Good afternoon. The case we're hearing this afternoon is number 17-1200, Vowell against the Navy. Ms. Wu.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I am Jennifer Wu for the petitioner, Mr. David Vowell. What we are asking for in this case is for Mr. Vowell to be given the opportunity to get back the job that he had for nearly 14 years. He was a materials engineer with the Naval Warfare Center in China Lake, California. Since his removal, he has not been employed and continues to reside there because that is where his family is. There appears to be no dispute that Mr. Vowell was suffering some sort of issues which resulted in him not going to work and improperly coding his time. We believe that the board erred or abused its discretion in imposing the penalty of removal because it discounted the significant mitigating factor of his depression. The only evidence in the record is from the psychologist, as to his mental illness, was from the psychologist, Dr. Seymour.
Am I correct in understanding that Dr. Seymour was a doctor that the Navy referred Mr. Vowell to?
Yes. The Navy referred Mr. Vowell to Dr. Seymour after the first meeting that he had regarding his absences. They noticed his absences, they being the government, noticed it on November 3rd, and he had a meeting about the absences immediately thereafter on November 4th, at which he was referred to the civilian help program, and then he was referred to Dr. Seymour, who he then saw in December as well as January. Dr. Seymour then provided three letters, which is the sum total of the medical evidence in this case. In each of the letters, he ties Mr. Vowell's depression from his absences, ties his depression to the absences he had. But both the agency and the board discounted that evidence, finding that that evidence was not near the time of his misconduct and also was not persuasive evidence that he was depressed at the time of his misconduct. What we are asking for here is that the board, this case be remanded to the board to properly consider that evidence in light of the fact that Dr. Seymour did in fact tie the depression to the period of misconduct. So starting with the first letter on January 8th, 2015 at Appendix 171, Dr. Seymour said that Mr. Vowell has been depressed for many months as a consequence of his job career and as a consequence of his long-standing marital problems.
I apologize, but what was the appendix page number you said?
171.
171.
There are three letters from Dr. Seymour. They appear at Appendix 171, 190, and 950. So those are the three letters. In the very first letter on January 8, 2015, which is summarizing the meetings that Dr. Seymour had with Mr. Vowell prior to this letter, he states that that Mr. Vowell was upset in the spring, which would have been prior to his absences, the spring of 2014. And he believed that he was not valued by the Navy. And here the Dr. Seymour says, as a result, his depression grew worse, and he began to spend more time at the other office. He started coming in late, even missing whole days, and realized no one seemed to care or notice. He again felt this reflected the Navy's lack of interest in him or his work, exacerbating his depression. It appears to us, at least, that this letter that thus indicates that the Dr. Seymour did believe that Mr. Vowell was depressed at the time of the misconduct. In the second letter at Appendix 190, the second full paragraph in the letter states that Mr. Vowell's depression and pending divorce clearly affect his self-destructive behavior, i.e. avoiding work and lying on his time cards. Again, Dr. Seymour is saying that the depression is what caused the misconduct. Nevertheless, the agency did not consider depression to be a mitigating factor for the misconduct. And the reason for this appears to be that Mr. Vowell had attempted to make an FMLA claim before the board and before the agency seeking to use FMLA leave for this period of depression. He ultimately was not successful in it, and we are not challenging that finding here. But the agency determined that the mental illness was not a significant mitigating factor because none of the letters said that Mr. Vowell was incapacitated.
Now, that doesn't go to the Douglas factors. I take it I'm making your point for you right now, but I think that that means your point, if I understand it correctly, is that under Douglas, it's just a consideration of the medical condition. here being depression, as opposed to requiring something more, which is what was required for that FMLA issue?
Exactly right. I mean, I think we believe that the agency conflated those two standards because those two claims were up before the agency at the same time. So they determined he was not incapacitated for FMLA and did not consider mental impairment, which is a lesser standard, in determining whether the penalty of removal should be sustained. The reason that we know that is because during the hearing, the deciding officer, Ms. Walters, was asked whether she considered depression as a mitigating factor in imposing penalty. This appears at Appendix 1114 and 1115. She was first asked by the administrative judge, Flick, how was it that you considered Mr. Bowell's depression in reaching the decision to remove him? And her initial answer was, well, I didn't so much look at his depression. I looked at the overall letters that came from Dr. Seymour. And then she talks about incapacity with respect to FMLA. The administrative judge comes back to it and says, did you consider how, if at all, Mr. Bowell's depression played any role in the misconduct that was before you? She then says, yes, this is the deciding officer, but follows it with, I also looked at the fact the letters didn't say that he was incapacitated. So then the administrative judge says again, I guess I'm just trying to figure this out. Did you give any mitigating weight to the fact that Mr. Bowell identified that he suffered from depression? She finally says, yes. It seems clear to us from the record that that conclusory yes doesn't support the agency's position that they applied a lesser standard than incapacity in determining whether Mr. Bowell's depression was a mitigating factor as to his misconduct. And on that basis, we believe that the only evidence in the record is that he was depressed at the time of the misconduct, and the agency's finding otherwise is an abuse of discretion. Now, when it comes to how the board analyzed that factor, the board simply adopted the agency's determination that the depression was not near in time to the misconduct and did not cause the misconduct. So the board didn't go back to the letters and reanalyze whether there was a direct relationship. And because of that, we believe that the board abuses discretion.
Just to make sure, you're going kind of fast, so just to make sure I'm following you. So when you're talking about the board, or do you mean the initial decision or the final decision?
The final decision. Okay. So the board at Appendix 14 said that the depression was not a mitigating factor because the effect, it wasn't clear that the effect of depression is what led to the misconduct. And it also said that it wasn't close in time to the actual misconduct itself. And, you know,
do you think that was based on the witness testimony as opposed to looking at Dr. Seymour's letters themselves?
Correct. There's been no real discussion of Dr. Seymour's letters before the board, and the government continues to argue in its red brief that there was no discussion of incapacity in the letters, seeming to say that the proper standard is incapacity as opposed to mental impairment, which obviously I think is the law. So as a result, we think that Mr. Bell should be given a chance to present his case in the context of this medical evidence that his misconduct was tied to depression and that there should be a balancing of that before the board.
I recall in your briefs that you referred to cases that supported the idea that incapacity is not required for the Douglas factors. Instead, maybe our court has said that it's not quite that narrow. What cases were you relying on?
There have been no cases that specifically say that incapacity is not the right standard, but all the cases that we've seen, including Douglas as well as Purifoy, Wensink, all of those cases refer to mental impairment. So we think that the law is clear that the standard is mental impairment, which we interpret just on the plain language to be something less than incapacity. We have not been able to find a case that says that the proper standard for Douglas factors is incapacity. It is, of course, the proper standard for determining whether FMLA leave is appropriate.
So how, if we were trying to draw some lines, but one of the things that obviously made an impression that they mentioned was the fact that he did realize that he wasn't coming to work and was changing the timesheets. And it looks as if they put a good deal of weight on the fact that he did have mental capacity, that he knew that something was wrong and was covering it up, and that it had gotten to be so extreme that reciting all of these contributing factors, they nonetheless felt that it was justified to terminate.
Correct.
Where does one find some kind of distinguishing advice or factor as to when it's gone too far?
That's a very good question, Your Honor. I think that in this case, he certainly falsified his time records and was also missing from work. I think those two issues are intertwined. They both resulted from his depression. Had he simply not shown up, we probably would have come to the same place. And we know that because when the administrative judge asked the deciding officer, what if he simply not shown up for work and not falsified his records? She said she would still come to the penalty of removal. So I think in this case, if you just look at the fact that he was absent for this period of time from June to November 2014, I think the question is when somebody has a severe or major depression, as Dr. Seymour said, and you miss a lot of work, and ironically for him, he was probably harmed by the fact it wasn't caught until November, is it appropriate to punish him by removal because it's been repeated and it's been so long? Our view is that the depression was one event that caused his absences. If you look at the facts of when he was absent, he began by being absent only two or three times a month in June. He then was absent eight or nine times in July, and in August he was absent more, and then in September he was absent a lot more. So this wasn't a situation where from the very beginning he was completely gone. He was just absent for a few days, and over time, as he was absent and as nobody called him out on it, as Dr. Seymour says, he became more depressed because he felt that no one cared about him. And that was true both at work and also at home. And then once he had the meeting, it was a wake-up call. They do care. He started seeing a counselor. He immediately went back to work, and he wanted to change his life and continues to go to counseling now. So in our view, this really is the situation of someone who had one life event that, you know, whether it was intentional or not, he'd had a bad moment in his life, and once it was called to his attention, he did come back. With respect to your question as to whether we should treat falsification and absence from work differently and where do we draw the line, I think we can draw some guidance from the NAVAIR instruction, which provides a table of penalties. The first offense says that you can either, for both of those instances, says that you can either impose a penalty of reprimand to removal. Obviously here they impose removal. The issue that we have with the analysis of the NAVAIR instruction is that the deciding official said that she didn't find the offenses in the table of penalties. At appendix 1117, she says that she didn't specifically see those in the table of penalties. So we know that she didn't actually look at the first offense recommendation. She just simply thought that it was so severe that she should impose the penalty of removal. We believe that the NAVAIR instruction gives guidance that in these kinds of circumstances where there's falsification and excessive time off from work, that there should be a robust consideration of the least severe penalty that is appropriate, and it's not intended to be punitive but corrective. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, I couldn't do any better. It's hard to tell. Let's hear from the other side.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll save you rebuttal time. Mr. Lyons.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. The deciding official and the Board considered the Douglas factors. The Board reviewed the deciding official's consideration and then reviewed the penalty that the deciding official decided upon, determined that it was within the reasonable bounds. That is what this Court's precedent and the system of federal employee discipline requires. It's not a new independent evaluation by the Board, which is what Mr. Bao is asking for. Because what the deciding official did and what the Board did is what is required, the decision should be affirmed. Now, we take that largely from this Court.
Can I ask you a question? One of the things the Board found was that Mr. Bao's medical evidence was not at or near the time of his misconduct. In looking at Dr. Seymour's letters, which I think is the only evidence of Mr. Bao's medical condition, he refers to his condition starting in the spring and that it has occurred over many months. How is that not then showing that it was at or near the time of his misconduct, which I understand spanned from, June to October or November?
Yes, Your Honor, the time frame's correct, and you're also correct. Those are the only evidence of his medical condition other than whatever testimony he may have given. The three letters, it's important to note the time in which they occur. The first one is January of the next year. It's already several months later, and in that letter, Dr. Seymour refers to many months of depression. There's a February letter that doesn't give a time frame, but does make the point that the depression in part is due to the fact that no one noticed the absence, which implies the depression comes before the absence.
But he had two offices. Maybe they just thought he was in the other building.
Well, certainly part of the problem the Navy has here is the way it's set up its these employees is it has to depend on them to be trustworthy, to record their time accurately, to report what they're doing, because there isn't one place they're always supposed to be. And that does lead to part of why the deciding official said no, given the length of time here and the nature of the offense and the lying on the time cards, removal's the right penalty. The third report, I think, is very telling. This is in June of 2015, and it comes after the administrative judge tells Mr. Ball that the reports I've received so far don't really show this incapacity thing. Can you get another report that might clarify for me? And the June 2015 report doesn't say many months anymore. It now says several months. This panel, the Federal Circuit's been very clear, the court doesn't engage in its own balancing of the evidence. And so I don't know that this panel should be reweighing the evidence, but were it to...
We're supposed to look at whether there's substantial evidence to support the fact-finding, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
What about the reference to spring? One of those letters refers to conduct that occurred in the spring that started his downslide. It might have been marriage issues.
But I believe, though, it says as to the depression, we have many months in January and several months in June. I don't believe, and this is an important point that gets called out to Mr. Ball, you know, is it for the whole period or isn't it? There's evidence, and you could say, well, it could have gone either way, and perhaps it could have, but the board, the administrating decision official looked at it, the board looked at it, and the way they interpreted the evidence was that it fell on the side of doesn't cover the period, which leads to the board's conclusion of it doesn't cover the time. They also say in the alternative, it's also not dispositive of the issue. We don't find it convincing because of this period of it's not just that he's not coming into work. It's that he's coming in at least once a week and falsifying time cards. He's also coming in and just not doing his job. He's walking around and talking to people, giving the appearance that he's there. There's a lot of evidence that, again, sitting in the first instance, the court...
I understand what you're saying. I guess my problem is I don't see that in the board's decision. You know, the board's decision where it talks about how Mr. Ball's medical evidence was not at the time or near his misconduct, it's pretty short. There isn't much of a discussion. I see no reference at all to the Seymour letters. I see no discussion that allows me to understand what their thought process was as compared to what you're explaining to me right now.
Well, Your Honor, I respectfully I'd state that what the board is doing, the full board, is they're reviewing the initial decision, which does go into significantly more length based on...
With respect to the Douglas factors, does it? Or is it more with respect to earlier decisions on the merits?
I believe what the administrative judge says is he goes through the Douglas factors and then he addresses the deciding official's analysis. And he says she undertook a holistic approach where she looked at all of these factors and came to a conclusion. He does not go through each one. He says, well, I've heard her testimony about what she did as to each factor. The testimony is lengthy and goes in great detail on many of them. And he says, well, holistically, she balanced them all, which is what she says she did, and came to a decision that she felt was appropriate given the nature of the offense and the mitigating factor of depression. It's worth noting in that subsequent to the testimony that Mr. Bao's counsel read into the testimony, there's further testimony from the deciding official at the appendix at page 1118, Mr. Ball cross-examines the deciding official and says, can you tell me what you did about my depression? Did you weigh my depression?
Can I ask you something else? Because you're relying on the administrative judge's decision now. Now, when I looked at the administrative judge's decision in discussing the Douglas factors, and that one in particular, in discussing the depression in the context of the Douglas factors, does talk about this incapacity being required. It says that the evidence doesn't show that he was incapable or did lack capacity. What? Is that the right standard?
I would say no. For purposes of the Douglas factors, incapacity is not required. What the administrative judge says, though, I believe as to the Douglas factors specifically, it says the deciding official looked at the various Douglas factors, and I'll see if I can give you the reference. Right. At the appendix at page 39, and goes through it, Douglas, the board has enumerated a non-exhaustive list of factors that may be relevant to a determination of discipline in a particular case.
But what about on page 40? It says specifically, the appellant contends Walters incorrectly assessed Douglas' factors. Specifically, the appellant claimed depression prevented him from intentionally committing the offense. And then says no medical evidence of the appellant's capacity to form intent had been compromised. That's the detailed discussion of that factor on page 40 following the recitation of the Douglas factors on page 39.
But, and perhaps I misheard you, or perhaps I'm not seeing your reference.
Page 40.
Yes, Your Honor.
There's it's the first paragraph that starts, the paragraph that starts, the appellant contended Walters. If you look at the next sentence, it talks about intentionally committing. And then there are a few sentences down. It says no medical evidence of the appellant's capacity to form intent had been compromised. So it sounds as if, how I'm understanding this, is that in the context of the Douglas factors, in looking at the depression, they're looking at whether the depression had anything to do with the capacity to form intent, which you've just said is not the proper way to analyze depression in the Douglas factors.
And I now understand your question. For purposes of FMLA, the question is incapacity. Because you can't retroactively invoke FMLA leave unless you were incapacitated, physically incapable of making the request. And we agree that that's the standard for FMLA. For the Douglas factors, that is not the standard. But what the administrative judge is saying here is not addressing incapacity as in you are physically unable to do anything. He's responding to the contention of my depression made me incapable of having evil intent, bad intent, and he's saying, no, I don't find the medical evidence supports the lack of capacity to form that intent. I don't understand the administrative judge here to be saying that Mr. Ball is saying the evidence doesn't support I'm incapacitated, and he has to find complete incapacity for purpose of the Douglas factors. So it's fundamentally a confusing situation because these two separate claims are part of what Mr. Ball put before the board.
Right, but the other issue is addressed in other parts of this opinion prior to appendix page 40. So I don't understand why in the context of Douglas discussion, which starts on page 39, there's a discussion of capacity with respect to the depression.
When I think it's from that second sentence in that paragraph you've pointed me to, Your Honor, where the claim, at least the claim the administrative judge understood Mr. Ball was presenting on the Douglas factor, was that depression prevented him from intentionally committing the offense. And that's the capacity issue. Did he have the capacity to intentionally commit an offense? Different than complete incapacity to submit an FMLA request, which are different things, though perhaps in light of the earlier discussion of FMLA, a different word choice could have been used. But he's responding to this issue that Mr. Bowell is putting before him.
Where does he address the medical condition then?
For purpose of the Douglas factors? Or for
yes.
Well, he addresses it, I'd say, in addition to in this paragraph, twice before on pages appendix 39 and 40, he specifically states that he's confirmed that the deciding official looked at mitigating circumstances, which is here the depression. That's the mitigating circumstance that Mr. Ball is relying on. And again, it's not an independent review. The administrative judge is to be looking to see, was there a
Where
review?
Where is that?
On page 39, in the paragraph that continues from the preceding page, just before there's a citation to Douglas, oh, I'd say five lines from the bottom, an awkward reference, I'm sorry, but two lines above that, he specifically calls out any mitigating circumstances surrounding the offense. And then on page 40, in the paragraph that again carries over from the preceding page, there's a sentence that begins, to wit, and it reads, to wit, Walters explained her decision in terms of the salient Douglas factors, and there's a parenthesis, e.g., and it goes for a while, and the last one he calls out as Walters, the deciding official calling out, is mitigating circumstances.
How do we know that there wasn't a misunderstanding on the part of the administrative judge in thinking and dealing with all this intentionally committing language, that this wasn't there wasn't confusion as to what Mr. Bowell had to prove in order to have mental illness be considered as a mitigating factor? And also, what is it that the AJ would have to discuss the actual evidence itself? I'm struggling here as being on a court of review. I'm struggling with understanding what the administrative judge was thinking when there's no discussion at all of the medical evidence.
Taking our guidance from the Hayes Court, where the board is not proceeding de novo, but is giving at least some deference to the agency decision, what this court has instructed the board to do then is not to engage in a brand new evaluation of all the evidence, but to ensure, yes, these factors were looked at.
But I understand that. We're not going to find facts, but we need to be able to look at an opinion and be assured that the factors were understood as they're properly required to be understood, not as an intentional committing the offense or capability, whether you're culpable or not, based on your mental illness.
But the administrative judge specifically states, I've looked to make sure mitigating factors are considered. And the confusion that Your Honor is calling up is, if anything, the confusion that Mr. Bowell brings in by saying, wait, you can't find against me on the Douglas factors if my depression prevented me from intentionally committing the offense. So to the extent that shouldn't have been inserted in there to begin with, that's the argument Mr. Bowell is making, and the administrative judge is responding to it, which, again, the administrative judge here and the board generally is not engaging in a brand new evaluation for the reasons this court said in Hayes, that there are hundreds of agencies and thousands of decisions every day, and it's not for the board to engage in a brand new evaluation of every one of those decisions for reasons of simple lack of for reasons that it would make the system we've established untenable. For those reasons, Your Honors, we would ask that the decision be affirmed.
Your Honor, we respectfully disagree that the AJ did not explain its reasons for not considering the medical evidence. At Appendix 41, footnote 5 expressly addresses the medical condition and says that the AJ concludes that the medical condition was not a significant mitigating factor under the circumstances. The AJ makes clear in that footnote that the reason the AJ reached that conclusion is because it conflated the standard for incapacity with mental impairment. I quote from the footnote, it says that Mr. Bowell claimed that mental impairment played a part in the charged misconduct, but unlike the appellant in this other case, Bowman, Mr. Bell failed to offer persuasive evidence that his medical condition played a part in the charged misconduct. In fact, the medical evidence offered did not establish incapacity. The appellant failed to establish his medical condition ever rose to the level of incapacity, and unlike in Bowman, there was not compelling evidence of medical impact around the time of the charged misconduct. Therefore, we disagree with the government's lawyer that there was a poor choice of words earlier in the decision. The AJ expressly said that she relied on an understanding of mental impairment to be required to rise to level incapacity in discounting the medical condition as a significant mitigating factor. For those reasons, we respectfully request that this case be remanded to the board.
Any questions from this room? No more questions? Okay, thank you. Thank you both. The case is taken under submission. That concludes this panel's argument this afternoon.
All rise.